BN Blitz Podcast. Buffalo Bills getting ready to face the Cincinnati Bengals at Paul Brown Stadium Sunday. Vic Carucci, Jay Skirsky going to break it down for you. Topics today we will cover. The secondary. What is up with a unit that has given up seven passes of 50 yards or more? That's the most in the NFL, the most that the Bills have allowed through their 16-year playoff drought. Pretty much a big reason why this team stands at 4-5. We'll get into what is happening with the defense in general, and are they wasting some good offense? Because the offense played a good game in Seattle. Tyrod Taylor, probably the best game of his time with the Bills, of his career as an NFL starter. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the offensive line, some shuffling going on there. How will the Bills overcome, if they can overcome, the loss of Eric Wood out with that broken leg that he suffered against Seattle? And this stretch run, seven games, seven AFC opponents. Do the Bills have to run the table? It kind of looks that way when you go over the math to have any hope whatsoever of making the playoffs. I mean, that challenge is enormous, and Jay and I will break that down. And as always, we're going to get into your questions. You've submitted a bunch of them to us at Vic Carucci, at Jay Skirsky on Twitter. So let's start with the secondary, Jay. And tough talk from Rex Ryan, where he basically says teams aren't fearing going vertical on the Bills. And typically, I mean, when you have the head coach say something like that, there was a big crowd of reporters around in that secondary area of the locker room on Wednesday after Rex said that. But I didn't get the drift from listening to Stephon Gilmore, some of the other players in the secondary, that they're totally buying the idea that it's all on them. In fact, Stephon Gilmore wanted to make it clear, hey, we're asked to play a lot of man-to-man coverage. You're going to get beaten man-to-man.
Yeah, and they have. That's certainly the case, and the numbers sort of bear that out, particularly when you look at the big plays. And I think that's what it's boiled down to, is that seven plays of 50-plus yards have been given up by this team, and that is just far too many. I mean, and it's kind of interesting. In this week's scouting report, I wrote, you know, statistics can lie sometimes. I mean, the team, the Bills rank 11th in the league against the pass, I think, right now. But if you watch this secondary, it does not feel like they rank 11th in the league against the pass. I mean, and that's because the errors have been so noticeable. The 50-yard touchdown passes that have come on 3rd and 13 against New England, or 2nd and long, and they're picking up 50 yards against Seattle to set up a touchdown. So the errors have just been so magnified in this secondary, and I think that's what has been that. You know, that's driven these, you know, this talk about potential, you know, big time changes, Vic. I mean, we're talking in week 11 of the season, benching guys because of performance. I mean, that is not real common in this league. Usually a new starter is because of, you know, of injury. It's not because, hey, we don't have the answers right now. And that's kind of where they're at right now. And I think the bye week factored into that a little bit. They had some time to look and see, you know, what can we change up, if anything? And we'll see on Sunday just how different this secondary looks. But it is pretty clear, and you had the details in here in listening to Rex Ryan, he feels that something needs to change back.
Something needs to change. Now, we know Ronald Darby sat down for a good portion. He was benched during the Seattle game. For whatever reason, Rex Ryan threw out the fact that, or at least I'm going to dispute that this is a fact, but he used a reason as sickness, or that he was sick. And he stuck to that, interestingly, on Wednesday. But to go from him being sick to then being challenged for the job, Corey White, the guy who replaced him in the Seattle game, that there is now a fight to keep the position. Those two things just don't go together, and I'm not buying that there was some illness in play. Ronald Darby didn't seem to use that as any sort of explanation. He obviously wasn't happy when this was brought up to him on Monday, and he shouldn't be at this stage. I think he's at a real tough spot in terms of proving his worth, I guess, to this coaching staff. And it's a huge deal, as you said, not only the timing, second round pick last year, someone that Doug Whaley was more than happy to tell the world about after the season that, hey, you guys were all over us for this pick, not only the character questions that came up on draft day in 2015, but also the fact that he struggled as a rookie badly, and we wondered during that preseason, where is it going with this kid? Well, he had an outstanding rookie year, I thought, and looked like he would be. I know Pro Football Focus had him ranked among the top corners, certainly in the NFL, and as a rookie, he looked like a defensive rookie of the year candidate. He hasn't looked like that at all. Stephon Gilmore, I think, has looked worse, and yet you have, I'm talking about an overall body of work for the season, and yet Rex Ryan doesn't seem to hold him to the higher degree of accountability. I'm not sure why on that one.
Yeah, it's a weird one. And I guess I think it with Gilmore, what's going on is that the consistency is just not there. I mean, when he's been good, Rex has said that he's been great. But when he's been bad, it's been so noticeable. And I think that it's easy for fans, and it's understandable, to latch on to those failures. And particularly, you know, let's face it, Gilmore is being paid $11 million this year, wants to be paid among the, you know, top, what, five cornerbacks in the league.
I think he wants to be the top paid cornerback.
So, you know, he's costing himself millions. We've talked about that in recent podcasts, that, you know, he's going out on the field and costing himself money when he performs the way that he has, you know, particularly against the Jets, against the Patriots, when Chris Hogan is running up and down the field on him. So it's pretty interesting what's going to happen with Gilmore, but then in the sense that they drafted Darby, okay, yes, that was a good pick. It looked like a really good pick. Well, if Gilmore leaves, Darby becomes your number one cornerback. What is benching him with seven games remaining in a season where, you know, you're expected to make a playoff push? Don't you need this guy on the field? You wonder what that does to his confidence. So it's a really interesting tactic that I think Rex Ryan is taking here to sort of coax the best out of him if he can. And, you know, he said that he's looked good in practice this week, bouncing back. Well, you know, that's going to have to show up on Sunday, because this was a strength of the team coming into the season.
Right.
What we presume to be maybe the strength of this defense was those two cornerbacks, Darby and Gilmore. Well, now you're looking at a situation where Gilmore might be gone after this year because he's going to want too much money, and the Bills aren't going to want to pay him based on what they've seen from him. And you've got a cornerback in Darby who you would have felt reasonably well, okay, this guy can take over as that number one cornerback. Well, not if he's getting benched for I almost said Jeremy White of WGR fame there, Corey White. Not if he's getting benched for Corey White. You know, you're not going to feel as good about him being a number one cornerback.
Right.
So they've got a lot of questions in the secondary all of a sudden.
They do. And let's talk about the matchup, because that's a big part of this conversation. And I'm positive that was in the back of Rex Ryan's mind as he was talking about maybe this overhaul of a secondary going into a game against Cincinnati where you have big targets, where you have A.J. Green and Tyler Eifert and Brandon LaFell and Boyd. They're big receivers, and it is pretty much a passing game, like passing games the Bills have seen all season, where the quarterback, in this case Andy Dalton, puts it up for grabs, and those taller guys win those jump ball battles. So it's something he's trying to reduce. That's had a lot to do with these seven receptions of 50 yards or more that the Bills have given up, and that number clearly has to be stuck in their collective craw. So I think that's something to look at, and more than probably, Rex Ryan definitely on Thursday was saying that in talking about Nickell Robey-Coleman possibly being moved out of that nickel role, right, and being replaced there, that had something to do, or maybe more to do, having Kevon Seymour, the rookie there, having more to do with a taller corner, longer corner like Seymour, or nickelback, I should say, match up better.
Yeah, and that makes sense, too. You know, particularly when you think, you know, Eifert is sort of rounding into shape for Cincinnati now that he's back from injury. He's a huge target. And, you know, you think back to that New England game where Robey-Coleman somehow stupidly gets matched up on Rob Gronkowski. I mean, that is an absolute mismatch. But it was sort of a head-scratcher that, you know, you heard him say on Wednesday that he had been benched and that Kevon Seymour was taking over, because I think for a big portion of the season, Roby Coleman has been their best cornerback. So maybe this
cut their last two interceptions.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I think he's took one of those back for a touchdown, right? I believe against what was it against
the Rams?
Out in LA.
Yeah.
So for a good portion of the season, I thought he had been their best cornerback. So it was kind of interesting to hear, but maybe it is more of a one-week thing. Maybe it's a light a fire under the entire secondary thing. I think there's a lot of that going on. I think Rex Ryan is sort of digging deep into his motivational toolbox here.
Absolutely.
To get these guys going in the right direction, because he knows it has to turn around. Because, you look at these last 2 weeks, Vic, and yes, I know, you're going against Tom Brady, Russell Wilson, on the very, very short list of best quarterbacks in this league, certainly with Brady at the top of that list. But, you've got another challenge coming up here with Andy Dalton a couple weeks down the road, Derek Carr in what could potentially be the game of the season for this team. So there's still a couple quarterbacks on this upcoming schedule, the immediate schedule, that are going to test these guys, and the Bills need them to be at their best starting Sunday.
So secondary, the biggest concern of the defense, but a bigger picture look at this unit, and Jerry Sullivan wrote an outstanding column about this that's available online, of course, and you can read it in the Thursday Buffalo News print edition, where he basically says the Bills could be wasting as strong an offense that they've had as they've had in a while, and talking about the scoring pace being right up there with what they had during a Super Bowl era team with Jim Kelly at quarterback. So yes, they've produced those points. I know the points, I think the total points he dealt with would include like a defensive score, but still, we're looking at a pretty productive team from a scoring standpoint. Hadn't seen that in a while from the Bills' offense, and that Seattle game was very encouraging if you're looking at for reasons why Tyrod Taylor should remain as the quarterback for this team and fall into that franchise category. So is the defense, because what Sully pointed out was statistically overall pretty close to last year's disappointing numbers, kind of top to bottom, other than a very noticeable improvement in the sack category. They lead the league with 30 sacks. You can't ignore that, Jay, but to you, does it overcome? Does it either cover some of the sins, not only that you see on the back end, but in general?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you look at that Seattle game, a perfect, I think, example of what Sully was getting at was the start of that game. Jerry Hughes blocks the punt. The offense takes over the 3-yard line. Tyrod Taylor runs in. Beautiful little keeper play. They're up 7-0. What's the one thing you want to do in Seattle is try to take the crowd out of that stadium. I mean, it's known for impacting the game for the home team in a positive way. And the defense, the second play from scrimmage, gives up a 50-yard pass. So I can totally understand when, you make the case that you're getting enough from your offense, from your special teams, that you should be able to win games. And, Jerry had the number of games that they've lost in which they've scored 25 points. I mean, it's too high. And that goes back to the defense. It has to get better. This was supposed to be the year, Vic, that the defense was going to be quote-unquote fixed. And
yes,
you've written about that. You've reported on that quite a bit heading into the year about how Rex assured people inside the organization that the defense would get fixed.
Absolutely.
What has gotten fixed? The pass rush, sure. Absolutely it has. The front seven, I think you've gotten a lot of good play from the linebackers. Preston Brown and Zach Brown, I think, have given them some nice games. But you look at the run defense, it ranks 20th in the NFL right now. We just spent a good portion of time talking about the struggles that the secondary has had. And overall, this defense has been at fault, or I think has shared more, or is maybe shouldered more of the blame for some of these losses than the offense has. You particularly look at week 2 against the Jets. You look against week 7 against Miami. And then the last 2 weeks, there's 4 of your 5 losses right there. And, the other loss against Baltimore, the defense was very good. That was one that you'd put on the offense. But in 4 of their 5 losses, it's been the defense at fault.
Yeah, and that certainly paints the kind of picture that when you start looking, taking a hard look at the futures of your coaching staff and everything else as we get into the latter part of the season and get into those discussions, still pretty early for me to go there, but people do go there. That's gonna come up. How much balance do you put between improving, fixing the sacking part, the pressure part, which is the signature of Rex Ryan and what he promised to deliver and fell woefully short of that in 2015? That improvement, how much weight will that carry when ownership has to review and see where they are with this coaching staff? And then also, how much is the coaching staff truly to blame for those problems? Because again, we know why those duds of defensive performances, where they have really been found, and it's been in the secondary. I mean, it's been in that area that we didn't expect to fall down. Now, an easy place to go is, did they make a mistake by parting ways with Donnie Henderson, and is part of the problem that their current coaching staff doesn't do enough with that secondary? That's Rex, obviously, and not surprisingly, dismissed that out of hand when asked about it Wednesday.
Yeah, and I think that I would maybe side with Ryan on that a little bit, because I don't think that, for me, it starts with the communication, and I know that was the topic. I have not seen, at least it doesn't feel like to me from watching the games in the press box, that there have been glaring communication errors, the type that we saw so often last season. Now, there were a couple against New England. I think, Gilmore getting beat by Hogan certainly was maybe the biggest example that you could point to. But to me, it's just more that the guys are getting outplayed. Stephon Gilmore, Ronald Darby are giving up plays that we didn't expect that they would give up, whether that's technique, whatever you want to call it. It's just they're simply getting beat and getting beat way more often than we thought. I think another thing that factors in here is the loss of Aaron Williams. When you
Huge,
look at their numbers without him in the lineup versus when he is in there, it's a big difference. And I know, again, I'll point to the quarterbacks that they've played since that time, probably the best two on their schedule. But you can't underscore just how important he is to that defense, and they haven't been able to overcome that. So I don't know necessarily that I would point to maybe in Darby's case, though, the loss of Henderson could be a big one, because certainly he has not performed the way that he did as a rookie. And we saw, and it was always fun to watch at training camp, Donnie Henderson was a very, very hands-on,
yes,
vocal coach.
Animated.
Mm-hmm. That style works for some players. I think it's a very good question to ask of Darby and Gilmore, maybe to a lesser extent. Gilmore, because he's been around for so long. But Darby, that was his introduction to the NFL, was Donnie Henderson. And certainly you have to wonder whether his absence is maybe being felt a little bit there.
And you can't ignore when Stephon Gilmore does make the point of talking about the type of coverage that he's involved with now and has been for now his second season with Rex Ryan as head coach, man-to-man on everything. And it certainly can come off as so much excuse-making for those, and I don't think Stephon has a lot of support from a fan base that just sees highly paid corner who wants to be even more highly paid not delivering and stops the conversation there. But in his defense, there is something to that. It is a different scheme and a different way of playing defense. So perhaps that comes into the equation of the overall question of this defensive the defensive issues that are there. That, once again, is the scheme right for everybody? A. B. How long does it really take to get everybody aboard? We've seen, look, the sack thing changed in 1 year in large part for, here are the reasons. Mario Williams is gone, right, who didn't buy into it. And the guy who effectively replaced him, who was supposed to be Shaq Lawson, is Lorenzo Alexander, a journeyman who leads the league with 10 sacks. So that explains, that's a clear A to B sort of thing. The other part of it is, in general, Jerry Hughes, Kyle Williams, go down the list, Corbin Bryant, other people who are in this defense, and then adding Leger Douzeville, who is new but who had familiarity with the scheme, right? The knowledge level is greater. I think that matters.
I think it does, too. But I think what also matters is that they're performing up to our expectations for them. You know, I think Jerry Hughes is having a very solid season. I think, you know, well, in Alexander's case, he's blown away every reasonable expectation. But Kyle Williams has come back and been the player that we've gotten, you know, known for so long.
Preston Brown.
Preston Brown has returned to that level, and maybe you point to that second year and being more comfortable in the scheme as being a big difference for him. But in regards to Darby and Gilmore, that's where it's such a head-scratcher, is that they've gone backwards, and it just doesn't there doesn't seem to be a good reason or explanation for it. And I don't think that Rex Ryan has one.
Oh, I think he's at a loss at it. And when he says things like he was surprised to see the overall numbers not being stronger in on Wednesday, that too, you could tell he's perplexed. You could tell he's kind of searching for answers. Okay, offensive line, Eric Wood suffers the broken leg against Seattle. Looks like Ryan Groy, who was basically thrown into the lineup late in that Seattle game, backup guard, playing center, clearly out of sorts. I mean, he was struggling and struggling badly, understandably. But now it looks like he is the starter, taking most of the reps this week. The O-line in general, Jay, that will be a big change. And how is that handled, number one? And number two, what happens at right tackle where we saw Jordan Mills just get taken to school by Cliff Averill of the Seahawks?
Yeah, you know, a couple of interesting things here. We had LeSean McCoy vocalize it yesterday when he said Eric Wood is the most important player on offense for this team. I've also had people inside that organization tell me that very same thing privately. So that, I think, tells you a heck of a lot of what you need to know about what this injury to Eric Wood can mean for this team. I mean, I think most people would say, well, that's crazy. It's Tyrod Taylor. I'm here to tell you, the people inside that team believe the most important player on the offense is Eric Wood.
Totally.
Based on what he does for communication, based on what he does for leadership, leading that offensive line, signaling to, you know, to his line mates, they're blocking, you know, responsibilities, that sort of thing. This is not going to be an easy player to replace from an injury perspective. So Ryan Groy is going to have a huge challenge in front of him. Now, the team has been saying all the right things. You know, Richie Incognito who I think, you know, you sort of look to now for leadership along that line with Wood out, has said that they've got a lot of faith in Groy. You know, the good news is he's been there all season. He's been active. He's played in every game. He's played a number of different roles, from an extra tight end even to a tackle as a sixth lineman. He's played guard. We saw him against Seattle play some center, you know, struggled, as you mentioned there. So he's got some experience, but, you know, it's really interesting that they're going to have to kind of rebuild two of the five positions along this line now, with Groy going in and then that right tackle position being completely open now for competition. Anthony Lynn today made it seem like, and basically said as much, that we may see three players play there against the Bengals, and that would be Jordan Mills, Chantrell Henderson, and even Cyrus Quanjo getting a look. So they don't know what they're going to do at right tackle. And, you know, Jordan Mills has taken all but one snap for the team this season at that position, but given his struggles, particularly against, as you mentioned, Cliff Averill, you know, that third and goal play from the 8-yard line when the Bills have a chance to win the game, Cliff Averill blows by him, sacks Tyrod Taylor, basically doesn't end the game, but puts them in a really tough spot.
Yeah.
You know, I think that was the type of play where the coaching staff looks at it and say, you need to give us a block here. You can't give it to us. We might have to find somebody who can. And it's not an ideal situation, though, to be running through three different guys and trying to figure out which one of those three is going to give you the best play. So, you know, the offensive line, it's interesting. I think when you look at their rushing numbers this year, people would look at it and say, well, the line's playing pretty well. But there are some deeper statistics that some websites like Football Outsiders keep and things like that that show that the line has struggled in certain areas. In short yardage, they've struggled. In power situations where you need a yard or two to pick up, they have not done really well in those situations. And that really speaks to the line. A lot of the rushing numbers have come on scrambles from Tyrod Taylor, on big plays from LeSean McCoy, where, yes, you know, the line maybe blocks well to begin with, but then in that second level, he's making guys miss and taking what maybe were 10-yard gains, turning them into 20 or 30. So they've picked up a lot of yards that way, and I think that's kind of, hidden maybe some flaws of this line, and really it's going to be a challenge for them now moving forward. And it's not an easy start for Groy. I think coming out of the bye, you'd love to maybe have a home game where he could ease into it a little bit. He's not going to have that luxury. You know, he's going to have to go into a road game against a team that needs a win just as bad as the Bills do. So this offensive line is going to be challenged in a big way on Sunday with potentially two new pieces.
And I think the other thing that this line had going for it up to the Seattle game, for the multiple reasons, the Wood injury and then what we saw of Jordan Mills. And I think Jordan also had some earlier struggles, but was sort of keeping his chin above water, is now a lack of continuity. I mean, that is problematic. That is usually the number one thing that undoes a line. Look at the Miami Dolphins. A big part of the reason why they are ahead of the Bills and trending far better in the direction of getting a wild card spot than Buffalo from the AFC East, if there is one, is because of their offensive line's continuity. They've gotten healthy. They've played together. They're talented as heck. And everybody that they put in place there pretty much has played at a high level. The Bills may not have had everybody playing at a high level, or the high levels of some of their players would be considered okay maybe for other lines, but it was good enough, and maybe just between Wood and Richie Incognito, so much of the pulling and trapping that happened in their run game, and that's a big part of how this run game executes, was successful because you had those two doing it. You had also combined, you know, in age, 66 years old, I think, and in experience, what, 20-some-odd years? Something like that, maybe even more. But a lot of years between the two of them as NFL players who know what the heck they're doing. And I think, again, I think this team will miss that. And then if you're rotating a tackle, I hate that thought. I think I just hate it because I think it will lead to a jailbreak. By the way, Cincinnati, they are having problems galore stopping the run. You saw the Giants run all over Monday night. But they can get some pretty big and dominant and tough, gritty people inside, like a DeMeco Pekka, if I'm pronouncing that right, and some of the other people that they have who can bring some heat. And certainly there's a nasty surliness about that overall front seven that they have going.
Yeah, Geno Atkins.
Geno Atkins, yeah.
Huge challenge, actually. One of our colleagues, Mark Gaughan, loves Geno Atkins. I always remember listening to Mark talk about
he's a great player.
Kind of player he is, yeah. And, you know, it's interesting, you mentioned the Dolphins there, and their run that they've been on sort of started when they got that offensive line back intact. And I think of, you know, the Dallas Cowboys and the success that they're having this year and how heavily they've invested in the offensive line. And the Dolphins sort of kind of followed that philosophy a little bit in the sense that they have really made a commitment to the line. And the Bills kind of went halfway with it, you know, and maybe three-fifths of the way when you think about it. You know, they've got Cordy Glenn, who they've paid. They've got Richie Incognito, who they re-signed. Obviously, Eric Wood is on a second or maybe even third contract at this point with the team. So they have built that line pretty well, you know, where three-fifths of those starters you feel pretty good about. On the right side, it's been a little bit different. You know, they had John Miller, who I think has performed much better this year than he did as a rookie.
Right.
But he's still a younger player. And then at that right tackle spot, they were kind of just hoping to piece something together. And for a while, it looked like maybe Jordan Mills would be able to do it. That has kind of lessened now. So now you wonder, does the line kind of go from being serviceable to good to being a problem for the offense? And that's going to be something that I think over this final seven-game stretch run that we really keep a close eye on.
And a perfect segue, because let's talk about this final seven-stretch game run. It's dawning. Let's face it. The Bills find themselves already in an unlikely position of making the postseason, and it all really has to do with that 0-2 start, I mean, in particular, and then dropping a game that I think we were pretty confident that they would have a shot at winning at Miami. So you go down the list of maybe a blown opportunity. Now you could say, well, the makeups of that are beating Arizona, a team that they weren't necessarily expected to beat at home, and winning at New England. Even without Tom Brady, that was considered the tall order. But I still see losing to Baltimore as a problem, losing to the Jets as a problem, and then now throw the Miami game in there and just throw the entire 1-4 conference record in there. And it's very similar to those, you're trying those two-point conversions, I guess, that you miss, or extra points that you miss. What are you doing? You're chasing points during a game.
When you look at that, when you look at the standings and you see that there are three teams in the AFC West with seven victories, and the Bills are sitting at four wins with a 1-4 conference record, the math just doesn't add up for me. I just don't see how you get there, you know, and what it's going to take. And I feel like we have this exact same conversation every single season where you say, okay, well, if this thing happens and this breaks this way and this team loses to this team, they've got a chance. And I don't mean to, you know, completely just rain on everybody's parade here, but I don't see any way in you know what that, yeah, that they're going to be able to do this, because they have put themselves too far behind the eight ball in a year where a 10-6 record might not be able to get you into the playoffs. An 11-5 record might not even be able to get you in. Now, probably would if they were to run the table, but the last time they ran the table, Vic, 1990. You might remember that year.
Yeah,
it was the first Super Bowl year.
Yeah.
So it's not something that, you know, we can reasonably sit here and talk about with any sort of seriousness, because it's just not going to happen. The team isn't good enough, first of all, and it's just a 7-game win streak. You know, outside of the Patriots and, you know, a couple of other very few select franchises, they just don't happen in this league. I mean, this league is too close. There's too much parity to expect a team to run off seven straight victories. So, you know, I know it's before Thanksgiving, and you hate to write off their chances, but I just don't see any way. I mean, it starts Sunday in Cincinnati. They have to win that, and then maybe, you know, who knows? We'll see. But I think we're at the point now, Vic, where we're almost to the point where we're evaluating next season. And what do they do in 2017?
Yeah, it has that feel of it. And part of me, I'm never going to be able to say with any certainty what the mindset of a locker room is. That's always a dangerous business to get into, because you can't really take a temperature and know anything from being in there as to what players are thinking collectively. And they don't, generally speaking, don't think like fans. Fans are much more obsessed with how these 7 weeks break for them than the majority of players in that room. They are here and now. In their thought process, game to game, assignment to assignment, what have I got to do to keep my job and just continue to survive this league of attrition for everybody. So I'm with you. It's a daunting task, and that's putting it mildly. I had this team down for a 10-6 record that I thought would get them in the playoffs. I agree, 10-6. This is the year where it just doesn't look like it's going to happen that way, because of what we're seeing, the extreme success of multiple teams in the AFC West. And the other thing is, every game feels perilous. Cincinnati, where, I mean, you've got a 3-win team there, and you've got a team, I mean, they haven't won a game since October 23rd. It was the winless Cleveland Browns that they beat. So they haven't looked good in what they've done. I don't think I'm sure their fan base is already checked out, more so than the Bills fan base. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of support is there for them at Paul Brown Stadium, how disappointed the fan base might be, unless they just see this as, well, it's a maybe game for them, or a better opportunity for them to rebound. But they're discouraged. And from the Bills' standpoint, it is going on the road. And we just recited a bunch of areas where it could be very challenging for them, just because of the changes they need to make, and in particular that offensive line. Any noise at all, even if it doesn't replicate Seattle, it still will be noisy when the Bills' offense is on the field. I mean, that's a given. How much is that going to, again, impact your communication issues? How much opportunity do you have to have success with that? The other thing we look at is the rest of the schedule. a game. I mean, Jacksonville at home. You would assume, you'd want to assume that that's a game that you can't screw up. I know I say that, and then people are saying, "Shut up!" They could do that too. I know, but I'm going to say it. They don't screw that one up. If they do, then cancel the rest of the season. At Oakland, big problems. Obviously, Pittsburgh coming to town, problems. As much as Pittsburgh has struggled, yeah. Ben Roethlisberger comes to town. It's going to be at best a push of a game. I think it's a tough. They might be even, but I'm going to. It'd be hard for me not to like the Steelers better for all of their flaws and faults. And then you got the Browns, another one that if you don't win, cancel whatever you're doing after that. So of these remaining home games, though, they all look winnable. Miami may be, now that's the other one that I think could be problematic in light of what they've become. And then you got to close the year at New York. And wow, as much as we see a mess with the Jets, you just wonder if the Jets found out in Buffalo last year, those last outs are tough to get.
Wouldn't they just love to kick Rex Ryan while they were down, you know?
Give them a taste of the same medicine of last year, right?
Yeah, exactly right. I just see too many opportunities for this team to stub its toe down on that schedule that you mentioned there, you know. There's just too many opportunities for them to, just not have it in a certain week. And they don't have that luxury. Based on the way that they've played before the bye, they have to play near-perfect football the rest of the way. And one of the things that you and I talked about yesterday in the media room is just being in the AFC East gives this team no room for
error. No shot.
Because every season you're looking up at the Patriots, so you're not competing for the division. So that means that you're competing with 14 other teams for two playoff spots. And, you know, if you're the Bengals, you mentioned the fan base in Cincinnati. Well, they're, what, a game and a half? We looked it up. They're a game and a half out of the division lead. So even at 3-5-1, they can very well win that division, make the playoffs. I mean, that sailed how long ago for the Bills, the chance of winning the AFC East? You know what I mean?
Right,
It just becomes so difficult in the division with the Patriots to have any sort of hope of catching them. You're basically playing for a wild card every season.
Yeah, and you're right. Maybe I'm underestimating the fan base there having some level of enthusiasm to know, as crappy as the record is, they are in the AFC North, and really, can you beat out the Steelers? Can you beat out the Ravens, who are sitting atop there, I think, tenuously? And they're probably saying, yeah, you can. By the way, because they've seen them do it 5 years in a row.
Absolutely.
Be a playoff team. So.
Yeah, that's. Let's get to some questions. What do you think for Twitter?
Let's do it.
All right. Jilly says, do you think Gilmore's distaste for the Bills has any effect on the secondary play? Well, I mean, when she says distaste for the Bills there, I'm assuming that she means maybe frustration with management.
Over the contract.
I don't know. I think that each guy in that locker room is sort of worried about himself, and they want to see their teammates get paid. There's no question about it. I mean, they like when their teammates are rewarded for their play, but I don't think that anybody in that secondary is going out worrying about Stephon Gilmore's contract status. I think they're worried about their own, and they're worried about, you know, the team's record, but I wouldn't think that, you know, his situation is negatively impacting the secondary. Now, you could say, is it impacting his performance? You can make a case that it's in his head.
I'm certainly going to question his total focus, because I think this contract is preying on his mind. I thought from last year he had discomfort with this scheme. He's brought up this man-to-man thing before to me, and he brought it up again yesterday. So it's a problem in his mind. I like Stephon. When you talk with him, I think there's a sincerity about him. His pursuit and desire to be paid the most, go for it. I don't care. I'm not opposing that in my mind. I'm not going to say the Bills would give it to him, and I certainly, if I had the role of a GM or contract person for the team, would I give him that based on what I've seen? No. But in terms of Stephon the person, Stephon the player, I don't know that he if he's frustrated and upset with how the Bills are treating him, and it's showing up in his play, shame on him for doing that. He's a professional being paid more than $11 million. It can only hurt him in terms of his future. It's not very long to play in this league. You want an opportunity elsewhere. If that opportunity isn't going to come here, he certainly has to want it somewhere else, and by messing up because he can't focus on it, you are doing a disservice to yourself. You're giving another team a reason to, if it's either of the two things Jilly mentioned there, his own play, or you mentioned his own play, she mentioned maybe the rest of the secondary, that's another team's question mark then. For, well, then we don't want this guy, or we don't want to pay this guy.
Right, right. Colin Schultz says, what are the plans for re-signing Robert Woods and Zach Brown? Both would be pretty big losses. I agree with that second part. Let's start with the second guy first. Zach Brown, I don't know that the Bills are going to re-sign him. I think that they drafted Reggie Ragland to play the position that Zach Brown is playing. I think Zach Brown's young enough that he could reasonably expect a fairly big contract based on the way that he's performed this season. Now, inside linebackers, by and large, are not more of the well-paid players in the league, but I think he would want starter money from a team, and rightfully so, based on the way that he's played this year. Are the Bills going to be willing to pay him starter money for what might not be a starting job? I think that's a very big question right now, and one that I would say right now, if you had to ask me, I would say no. I think that they would let Zach Brown go on the open market with the idea that they drafted Reggie Ragland to play that position. Now, Robert Woods is another interesting one, because when you look at the receivers that this team has under contract next season, it's Sammy Watkins, Walter Powell, Colby Listenby, and I believe Marcus Easley. That is not much coming back at wide receiver. Outside, and really, you know, you start with Watkins. Well, who knows where he's at health-wise and where he's going to be at. You'd like to think that he'd be healthy by the time 2017 rolls around, but with him, we don't know right now. We simply don't know the condition of his foot injury. So what are they going to do at receiver? Are they going to pay Robert Woods maybe more than what you would think Robert Woods would make, because that's what happens on the open market is guys get overpaid? So I would say right now, if you had to prioritize the two based on numbers at the position, I'd prioritize Woods, but at what cost?
Yeah, and you had a great piece looking ahead to the contract situations that this team faces, more so than what? Any team in the league, right? I mean, it's
23 unrestricted free agents pending, which is, yes, leads the NFL.
And if you haven't seen that piece, please check it out. It really puts in perspective what this team faces. I'll say this much about Robert Woods and what we saw against Seattle. He worked primarily as a slot guy, a defense that was focused on taking away the Bills' run game and then spying on Tyrod Taylor, offered up a lot of opportunity, as you saw, in the flat and in underneath areas of coverage that he flourished in because he knows how to run those routes. He's a smart, savvy, instinctive player. I know this much. A scout, a great friend of mine who's a scout for an AFC team, said that if the Bills in any way cast this guy adrift, they're pouncing. So I know at least one team in the league that wants Robert Woods on its roster if the Bills decide that they don't want to keep him.
Yeah, when you look at the pending class of free agent wide receivers, Robert Woods is very near the top of the list, and that sort of factors into the cost that yeah. would be involved in re-signing him. There's going to be money out there for him. And if I'm Robert Woods, I'm getting to the open market because I don't think the Bills are going to use a franchise tag. I don't
know,
nor really should they. So I think he's looking at a payday.
He'll get paid.
Than what even fans might think.
He'll get paid.
Yep. All right. We've got one here from Patrick that I just want to address. He's asking about the DB play. And I think, Patrick, if you listened to the beginning of the podcast, we did cover a lot of that. Matt Williams says, how can the number one sacking team in the NFL also be allowing enough pocket time for quarterbacks to throw deep? I guess that's an interesting question. I think a lot of that maybe goes to play calling on the other side. You know, there's coaches on the other side too who are maybe picking the right times to dial up those deep balls and getting the protection at the right times. I think that factors into it. I mean, you have to sort of be realistic with the pass rush that it's not going to get to the quarterback every time. And you know, maybe just the timing has been right for those other teams that when they do have those deep routes called, they've gotten the protection that they've needed to allow those to develop.
I think that's a factor, and I think it's a factor when you really go deep into the numbers of the sacks. It could be just a number. In some ways, it could be just a number, that it's meaning beyond that in terms of real steady pressure that you provide may not be so great. And again, keeping in mind that the quarterbacks who have hurt this team with deep balls now, one of them was Ryan Fitzpatrick, and that one you could scratch your head on, that he had the opportunity to do that. But the other would be Tom Brady, and then Russell Wilson, when you looked at the games that those guys had against them. But when you're looking at Brady and Wilson, you say that's expected, even if they're getting sacked, when they make plays, and they do make plays. Now, I've seen quarterbacks get sacked upwards of more than six or seven times and still can come out with a win because there's plays made. They're not being sacked on every single down. So does it mean that on every down you're bringing that kind of heat? Can you match up personnel better? Can you throw to certain areas of the field more quickly, beat the rush, and have plays? And that is happening. I'd say generally without a true intricate analysis here, my sense is that you can still have success throwing the football when you're sacking, because you can hit specific plays, right, that match up against certain blitzes that a team brings, the risks. It's a high risk defense, so it's a risk defense hoping for the reward of sack and pressure, but sometimes it's just risk.
Yeah, right, exactly. And when you have coverage breakdowns, which we've seen going most recently against Seattle, when Baldwin gets behind Darby, that can happen because you can't expect the pass rush, like we've said, to get there every single time. All right, last one for today is from Frank LaFort. He says, in all seriousness, what will it take for Rex and crew to get fired? Can't believe Pagulas are happy with Bills now. Now, I should note that Frank has a Twitter avatar that says, Rex Ryan must be fired. So we know how he feels about the situation.
Yeah, that kind of gives it away.
Right, exactly. What will it take, Vic? I mean, I don't think that it's happening this year. I mean, I think that this team looks to me to be one of those, I picked 8-8 ahead of the season. I'm sticking with 8-8, and that's not going to get Rex Ryan fired.
That wouldn't, I don't think. The scenario that I could see, now if we're talking about anything can happen in the next seven games, if one of those anythings is a winless stretch here, sure. If they go and really go into the tank, lose them all, or say lose six out of seven, let's use the most extreme number that brings them to a season of 4-12 or 5-11 or whatever it might be, then I think the conversation, well, it'll first of all be intensified by fan base and media. It will be, the town will be screaming for a change. They'll want Rex gone. They'll want Doug Whaley gone. They'll want the whole thing blown up. And the Pagulas can insist that they won't hear it or ignore it. And they could, by the way, even that bad. But you know you're going to have the PR nightmare, if you will, of the whole bottom falling out, because a series of bad things could happen to get you to that point. I'm with you that the worst I can see this team finishing at this point, given the schedule, given the beatable opponents that remain in the majority of the seven that are left, that 8-8 seems like the worst scenario. I still say a 9 or 10 win season is on the table. Maybe 9 wins is on the table, but something that shows improvement over last year, but might not be playoffs. And to those who would raise the question, okay, what about playoff ultimatum? Well, again, I'm 1,000% for the information I got, that what I wrote about that back in January was accurate, on point. However, the owner of this team, to me and to anyone else who will listen to him, and he doesn't talk very much, Terry Pagula, one of the owners, has gone out of his way to stress that his guy is safe and good. There is no ultimatum. There's nothing, you know, nothing that would compromise his future. Perhaps he says, I think the closest we'll have disagreements and talk about things, but it's all the healthy stuff. So Terry Pegula does not want to be perceived as putting any sort of pressure whatsoever on his people. On that, I assume it's just kumbaya, love, hugs, kisses, drinks on the yacht down in Florida. You know, whatever down on Terry and Kim's yacht down in Boca Raton. God bless them, because I think they will tune out and tone out. Even if there is a, say, at 8-8 or 7 wins, a push that, hey, 17 years of no playoffs and we're stuck with this guy and how's it going to get any better? I don't think they want to hear that. In fact, it will only cause them to deepen the stance, or cause Terry to deepen his stance, that to keep Rex in place, because he does not want to be told by fans or media to make a change. He won't listen to that.
I agree. There's a lot there. I agree with a lot of it. I think that there's a couple of things that I think of when I think about these scenarios. The one is when Chan Gailey was fired by the Bills, and I know that was before you would come back to the news, but, you know, Buddy Nix, who was the general manager at the time, told anyone who would listen that we don't want to make a coaching change, until it just became so abundantly obvious to every single person watching the team that they needed to make a coaching change. And I think that for that same type of scenario to play out here, it would have to be an epic, epic collapse, as you mentioned there, an 0-7 or maybe 1-6 type of a collapse that has them picking in the top 5 of the draft and has Rex Ryan's defense falling down into the bottom, not just the bottom half, but I'm talking the very bottom depths of the defensive rankings in the NFL. That would be the type of collapse that I think would have to happen to even entertain this type of a conversation. Now, I don't expect that for a couple of different reasons. You know, number one is the schedule that you mentioned there. There are winnable games on this schedule. I don't think that they're going to collapse that way. I do think that they're going to be in that 7-8 win range. I disagree with you slightly that they'll get to 9-10. I don't know that this team can go 5-2 down the stretch.
I'm seeing a steal maybe here or there. That has to factor in a steal, an unexpected.
Yeah.
Which,
but we're not that far apart, you know, on our projections.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know, we're seeing basically the same type of an ending. And then if that's the case, we get to what you just mentioned there. And then the Pegulas, in the rare public comments that they have made, have stressed continuity. And they've stressed that we want to see this through. And that's why I think that Rex Ryan, I'm simply going to take them at their word on that for now and think that Rex Ryan will be back, because I don't think that he's been so overwhelmingly bad as to say that there, we don't have another alternative but to replace him. And I think, you know, another point I want to make here is when you look at their experience of owning the Buffalo Sabres, they hung on to Darcy Regier longer than I think most reasonable people thought they should have. And I could see a very similar situation unplaying here with Rex Ryan.
Yeah, you just can. And also, I think this is maybe the under-discussed element. I don't think they relish the idea of another search. This last search was a daunting process for them to go through. I think it was 16 candidates total, if I've got that number right. They basically talked with every single person who was up for any NFL head coaching job. That coach, assistant, whatever, out of work, had an opportunity to talk with the Bills, had an airing out, if you will, an opportunity to show what the Bills, what their qualifications might be to coach the Buffalo Bills. So they were thorough, at least in that regard. I don't know how the process itself exactly went, what the interviews were like, but we know that Terry and Kim Pegula were part of it. We also know that Doug Whaley and Russ Brandon managed it for them. They trusted them to carry it out. So how would a second go-around be? Would Doug Whaley be a part of a second search, or are they going to have to be looking for both people? Because I think if you were to fire your head coach, then I don't know how you necessarily come back with the personnel and all the other work is great and doing fine with you, because I think there would be more than a few folks who wondered about how that could come down, how it could only be the head coach whose arguments for staying are, I had a lot of people hurt, and did I have the greatest depth where I needed it the most?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the depth there. And that, you know, I just look at one position in particular, wide receiver, and it's very easy to question the way that Doug Whaley built this roster at wide receiver, knowing that Sammy Watkins had the foot injury that he had. I mean, what did they do to add depth at wide receiver outside of drafting Colby Listonby, who, by the way, is going to miss his entire rookie season in the sixth round? They did next to nothing to add depth at that position, and, you know, it's hurting them. So I think that, you know, you mentioned there the personnel. I mean, it would be unheard of for a general manager, in this case Doug Whaley, to get three cracks at hiring a head coach, which is what would happen if they were to replace Rex Ryan and maintain status quo in the general manager's office.
Yeah.
That would be really hard to believe.
It would be hard to believe, and again, I don't think that that is, it is something that they, as owners, that they just, oh boy, we get to go after, you know, get to try to hire someone else. They didn't want to do this with Marone in place. They didn't want to be in that situation. They were taught, they were forced into it. So they went through it again. Maybe they could say, well, we've learned from some things from that experience. No, they went out and got the most dynamic name they could find, splash kind of guy to help sell tickets and whatever, and you know, who would be out there a second time around? What would be the philosophy? What have they learned about team philosophy? Because this team is still sort of struggling for that. We still can't clearly put together what the whole mission statement of the Buffalo Bills football operation is. We know what the business operation is, and they're making money. You know, they're making it hand over fist and doing it well. And Russ Brannon, that's where he's mostly relegated to, or totally relegated to. But on the football side of it, exactly how does it mesh up? What is their team philosophy top to bottom? And I think you'd be hard-pressed to, and we're not going to try to do that now, but hard-pressed to define what that is. All right, great questions that we got from you via Twitter, and we'll come back with this next week to preview when the Buffalo Bills come back home and then take on the Jacksonville Jaguars. And while we have the opportunity, we wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. For Jay Skirsky, I'm Vic Carucci, and we thank you for listening to the BN Blitz podcast.